Welcome to Synapse, Think Tank of the Air, featuring influencers, creatives, and thought leaders in the Twin Cities. And now, here is our host, Steve Lebeau.
And welcome to Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. This is Steve Lebeau, and we have two guests with us today, two, I think, artistically oriented guests, although they have multiple orientations overall. We're here with Maddie Schwapek. Did I pronounce it anywhere?
You did. That was right.
Okay, we'll stop right there. But, no, Maddie's going to be a presenter at an upcoming event called Yellow Summit. And Synapse is an official media sponsor for Yellow Summit. So I'm actually doing my duty by having you here. And I'm going above and beyond duty having you here, Lana. Lana Barkawa?
Barkawi.
See, I had to get one name wrong.
No problem.
And you're the executive director, an unusual title, you're executive director and artistic director of MISNA.
Right. Yes, that's right.
So yeah. I've never seen a person wear both hats. That means you have like two sides of your brain.
Well, you know, we're a small organization, so we're an organization where we wear multiple hats.
Okay.
So you
switch them.
Yes, I do. I do a little bit of both. You know, we get the work done administratively and artistically too. But we also have, you know, wonderful people who do the sort of nitty gritty on our main programming, which I can get to.
Okay. We'll get to some of that. Okay, now just briefly in like a sentence or two, how did you arrive where you are now in your lofty position?
It may be hard to sort of summarize it in a sentence or two, but my background is in the sciences. I did a doctorate in biochemistry, and as I was in my postdoc, found myself really wanting to connect with Arab community. I was here in Minneapolis.
Well, there's probably a huge Arab community, right?
It's not huge, but I was separated from my family and sort of the community I grew up with, and you know, other places in the country and around the world. And found that MISNA was doing all of this really incredible forward-thinking programming, and I was just really drawn to it. And
so it was your personal biochemistry.
You could say that. Yeah.
The things went up, and you connected.
Right.
So it was ongoing. You didn't found it or anything.
I didn't. It was founded by Kathy Haddad, who's a local playwright and an English teacher. And started by a really smart group of founding board members with Kathy at the helm. And just really doing incredible work. It was launched in order to publish a literary journal, the only lit journal for Arab American writing in the country that remains true today.
National. So yeah. It was basically formed to attract you to come and help it to grow, I presume, right? Because now I went to a thing, it might have been a couple of years ago, about it was held at the Loft, and it was basically about media portrayals, or was it more misportrayals of, you know, Arabs and Muslims in general.
Yeah.
So
I wonder if that was a conversation about Islamophobia.
That's it.
And politics that happened in 2016 during the election.
Right.
That was during an Arab American lit conference that we co-presented with a national writing organization called RAWI. So we do various things. Our main projects are the literary journal and also the Twin Cities Arab Film Festival.
Okay.
And then we dabble in other things as well.
Okay, we'll talk more about that. But yeah. Maddie, how the heck did you become? I mean, Your list is things. Okay, you're a mechanical engineering student at the University of Minnesota.
Yep, that's correct.
I hear you're the music honcho of Radio K.
Music honcho is one way to put it. Music director is
music
what
director.
I do. Yeah.
Well, that's kind of the pedestrian way to.
Yeah,
put it.
Yeah. Music honcho is what my friends call me.
but then you're kind of you're a presenter at Yellow Summit, which is like the interface of creativity and technology and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So what's your actual interface?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. As a kid, I was always kind of like interested in both sides of sort of like what we typically consider separate things, where I was very artistically inclined. I loved to look at art, to participate in art, do all these things. I played music for a lot of my youth. And then I also really like science.
I just have to stop. Youth, she's right now you're 20.
I am 20.
Okay, so let's talk about your youth.
But yeah, and in addition to that, I was really always into science. I loved studying things like biology or getting involved in building things.
Well, you have two sides of your brain too.
Yeah, we have a lot in common in that way.
I'm with all these integrated people, and here I am kind of humping around on one half a brain.
Yeah, so working in radio has just kind of like opened up a lot of cool opportunities. I've kind of just like gotten thrown into the mix of speaking at different things or having different interviews. And when I heard about Yellow, I was like, this sounds like the perfect marriage of like both sides of my brain. And I'm really glad to get to participate.
Wow, that's good. So what music do you perform?
I played the oboe for like 10 years doing sort of just like orchestral stuff.
Okay, because you know, you don't hear a lot of oboe in pop music unless it's unidentifiable in a commercial or something.
Yeah, something like that.
So, but how did you? Now I know the last time I listened to Radio K, they don't do a lot of orchestral music.
No, I was really passionate about sort of like underground music, the local music scene, indie music in high school, and started listening to Radio K through that. And so once I started at the U, I was like, okay, I have to run away from Gopher Sports, Sky UMass stuff, and find my group of people. And so that's how I got started at Radio K, and it's been such a great fit there.
So Radio K was made for you.
Yeah, basically.
To walk in there and explore.
Yeah, started it back in whatever, 1993, because I knew I was on my way.
Wow.
I have to say that our one of our staff people, Nyla Taman, used to be the program director at Radio K.
Yeah, I've seen her name floating around. That's awesome.
Yeah, she's
so
wonderful. Yeah.
And I have a connection, too. Before it was Radio K, it was KUOM.
Yeah.
And I was an intern there way back when I was learning to actually cut tape on radio. So I'm from the razor blade and tape days.
Wow.
Where you would cut it. And sometimes if you made a bad edit, you'd have to go into the trash can and take out a piece of tape and put it tape it back in. And very precise and kind of a hypnotic activity to edit tape.
Mm-hmm.
So it was fun. And then when
analog.
I'm an analog
arts,
guy in a digital world.
Love it.
Yeah, we had a band in last Friday who did all of their stuff on tape. And it was so funny just seeing that like juxtaposed against a lot of other stuff that we have going on there.
Well, is that turning into a retro thing like records are, the old LPs?
A little bit. It's kind of trendy. Bands can crank out a bunch of tapes for really cheap versus like getting vinyls pressed is super expensive. And so you could sell your tapes for like $2 or $3 at your show instead of making fans dish out $20 for a vinyl record.
And then try to find a place to play the tapes.
Yeah, that's another challenge. I don't think they actually make tape players anymore. I don't know.
You have to buy a really old car.
Yeah, there you go.
They have them there. I remember. All of a sudden, I couldn't play my tapes on the new car anymore.
You had to
play a CD or something. Now, what was your PhD in? Biochemistry?
Biochemistry, yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, what does that even, do you do any of that anymore? I mean, is it just a latent part of your brain now?
I suppose that's true. Yeah, I don't practice biochemistry or I'm not involved in the sciences. As of about 7-8 years ago when I took on the director position at MISNA. But, you know, I find that a lot of the skills that I learned in graduate school are very applicable to running a small nonprofit. You know, you kind of learn how to be resourceful and a problem solver. And on some level, you know, a lot of what I do is grant writing. And on some level, whether you're writing a grant for your science project or your artistic project, there are some similarities and things that kind of there's a thread that kind of loops those together.
I think they use the same format of so-called scientific reasoning. Okay, if you do this, what great thing is going to happen in the world because of it?
Right, just sort of translating your ideas into something that someone who knows nothing about what you do can understand the value of, and also just knowing that whole grant writing and fundraising process is not mysterious, but there are people on the other side of the, you know, receiving button who are open to conversations and that sort of thing.
Boy, well, that whole thing is mysterious as far as I'm concerned. The grant writing, the money cometh and the money goeth. The one rule, I think, is if you get some, then it's easier to get more. At least from that source.
Yeah, I guess it's a muscle that you can, you know, kind of flex and practice and grow.
And then you're on the map.
Yeah. They've
received something, therefore it's the grantors are like banks, right? If you build up your credibility by getting a grant and actually spending it on what you said you would.
Yeah.
Credibility.
Yeah. And so much of it is about relationships and, you know, the people on the selection panels or the program officers see the value in what you're doing and see beyond the, you know, application that you're writing to the actual lived work that you're doing and the value that you're bringing to the community.
Hmm. Now, your community, as you mentioned, is ambiguous because on some things it's national and on other things like the film festival, that's, I presume that's local or regional at most.
That's true in terms of our audience.
Right.
It's our subscriber base is national and international for the literary journal. And our writers come from the Twin Cities and also are based nationally and internationally. So the journal does have more of a national presence, although it is very rooted here. And, you know, we publish here. We're very much devoted to being a local organization and living in the local ecosystem. So we publish our journal with local printers and, you know, work very locally in that way. The film festival does have a very international base of films and filmmakers whom we draw from. So we're showing debut cinema from Arab filmmakers in the Middle East and North Africa and also in the diaspora. So Arab filmmakers who are based wherever in the world. Increasingly, Arab American filmmakers are, you know, creating great films that we're showing, and also increasingly local and regional filmmakers are kind of emerging, and we love that because nurturing the artistic community in the Arab American community is something that we're very much passionate about.
Boy, because I think it's good that you're producing films, the Arabs around the world and also the diaspora, because the typical Arab that you see in a movie is usually a bad guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got a lot
terrorist,
yeah. Counter programming to do.
Is that
one of your big things in general? Is because I assume your audience is mainly Arab Americans.
It's really a mix in terms of our audience. Yeah. We definitely think about our audience in terms of reaching in and reaching out. So we're really motivated, and from day one, this is what Mizna has been all about, is to be a place for our community, to see ourselves reflected on the page, on the screen, in some facet of our truths, you know, that an artist is telling a story from their perspective that is going to be recognizable on some level to Arabs and Muslims in the audience. And that's so powerful, especially in the West and in the United States, when, as you say, our community is represented by others all the time in Hollywood and in the media and the news in really irresponsible, vilifying ways. So
how many Arab and or Muslim directors do we have in Hollywood?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know that I know the numbers, but there are an increasing number. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's what is his name? Ali Salim actually is a local. He's from Minnesota, an Egyptian filmmaker who was raised here, who made now I'm going to forget the film, but it might have been called Sweet Land or Sweet Home a few years ago. That was about a northern Minnesota small Norwegian farming community, and he's been an honored guest at our film festival. And there's also the director of the series, Mr. Robot, who's an Egyptian American director, and he cast an Egyptian American actor in the lead of that series, and that's a really well regarded series.
Yeah. It's so nice to have control, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Because you can change the script, you change the conversation, you tell three-dimensional stories that are not about Arabs being bombers, billionaires, and belly dancers, as we like to say. You know, yeah.
The big triad.
Yeah.
Geez, wow.
Right.
And Radio K, I have not listened to it lately because I'm old. But, you know, I used to listen to it because it was one of the places you would find out what are these young people listening to?
Yeah.
And that way before, what's that one now that's across the river?
The Current.
The Current. Way before The Current, you had Radio K. Mm-hmm. And then I think KFAI Radio had a few programs of maybe exploring the newer underground music. But basically, you were the one-person show, right?
Yeah, kind of like that. I actually interned at The Current, so it's interesting sort of having both sides of the river, both sides of that sort of independent, not-for-profit rock radio. Yeah, but Radio K has been around student-run since 1993 in that capacity. It's actually the oldest-running AM translator in the country. It's been around since, like, the 1800s, which is crazy. Used to broadcast football games in Morse code. And now we've switched over to some different programming.
Gosh, I can't tell you how rusty my Morse code is.
Yeah, I'm always trying to tune into the football game in Morse code and just find myself at a loss.
Was he in bounds or out of bounds?
Yeah.
But what kind of audience do you reach now? Because you are online also. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, those local boundaries, the signal, the broadcast, because KUM used to disappear when the sun went down.
Yeah, that's not the case anymore. We have FM signals, we have a mobile app, and an online stream that goes on 24 hours a day.
Gosh.
Yeah.
The power.
Yeah, really.
How do you keep an audience engaged? How do you know you find the right new underground stuff?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's kind of nice having social media as sort of like a feedback system. Because
they'll tell you.
Yeah, they'll let you know. Like if there's this one song that we are playing a lot of, and there was this man who used to call in and just say, like, whatever you do, don't play that song during my drive time, which is ridiculous. And we had other positive feedback about
Program
it.
Program for me.
Yeah, which is funny. But also, like, we have countless other positive examples, people tweeting at us like, wow, I just discovered this cool artist from Radio K and he's playing the Turf Club next month or something like that. Yeah, so it's kind of nice to have that sort of like more conversational aspect to radio where we're able to really interact with our like listeners and audience base digitally.
Well, I'm glad that radio is still surviving. It's kind of, you know, it's like when the digital revolution came, they all wondered about print. Is print dead?
Yeah.
And I guess that's still kind of a question, although it didn't die like they thought it would.
No, in fact, I think I just saw something in the news that independent bookstores are opening at a really surprising rate around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And then the big ones are closing, the big box. They all went online with Amazon, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or else.
Yeah.
Or else you don't go anywhere. Does your major, Maddie, in mechanical engineering, does that have anything to do with radio?
You know, I thought for a while that it wouldn't, but I find so much more crossover than I expect. Like, there's this big database that we use to program music in our library, and it's used sort of across the industry called Music Master. And I had this kind of epiphany this summer when I was doing a lot of, like, nitty-gritty stuff in it, where I realized that it functions a lot of the same way as one of the computer languages that I had learned the semester before. The way that, like, familial trees and databases and pointers and all of that, you know, sort of like techie garbage works in this computer language was so similar to this like program that we were using to run radio. And that like totally changed the way that I thought about it. And it was, I don't think I would have that sort of experience if it weren't for going to school in STEM.
Gosh, I feel kind of overwhelmed here because I'm kind of an un-STEM guy. My forte is words and ideas and numbers. I never got along well with numbers, and here I am with two scientists. So it's a little bit intimidating, but you're crossover scientists. You get into the arts as well as to all of the scientific stuff.
Well, you know, I don't think that I think science gets a rap of being really dry and not creative, but I think the best scientists, maybe you agree, have to really be creative because science is about discovery and it's about asking questions to understand our world and then crafting the right experiment to answer that question. And you know, in order to do those things, you really have to think unconventionally and not be, you know, I think trapped by what the common understanding of the world is.
Well, that's a good thought. We're going to return to that in a moment. Maybe it's just the way they teach science that's so dry and
that
boring.
That is a problem.
So we're talking here with Lana Barkawi and Maddie Schwapik. We'll be right back.
Synapse, think tank of the air. We'll be back in a moment.
And we're back. I'm Steve LeBeau with Synapse Think Tank of the Air. We're here with two guests, Lana Barkawi. Did I say that closer?
Yeah, that's right. Lana Barkawi.
Lana Barkawi. Yeah.
Okay. No, wait, but you got it.
Okay, Maddie Schwapik. They're both science-oriented people dealing in a lot of artistic realms. Lana, you oversee a lot of, there's a film series, there's the literary productions. Mm-hmm. Is there a productive art side of you too? Do you want to make a film? Do you want to write a poem?
You know, I haven't had an artistic practice, so I can't say that. I do enjoy to draw, and I do enjoy I do enjoy writing. I just don't really make time for those things, but I desire that. I intend to.
Well, at least you like that stuff.
I do, yeah, yeah. And I have two little kids, and it's kind of fun to kind of, you know, tap into that creative spirit of childhood by, you know, shepherding kids through their first years.
How old are they?
There's 8 and 10. So okay, third grade,
so
they're
real humans
fifth.
By now.
Yeah, they are. They're pretty fun.
Going
fun
around, they,
people.
They're potential to be dangerous.
Yes.
They know what to do.
That's
and they know they're in control when they want to be.
Yeah, it's a lot of negotiating.
Wow. And I won't even ask you about kids, Mary. I mean, you're not a kid because you can look back on your youth.
Right, yeah. I'm 18 years old. I'm over 18 years old. I can sign leases. I can, I don't know.
No, you can vote.
I can vote. I do that.
Now, what about alcohol? What's the latest age for that?
It's at 21, so I still have a few months before I can.
So that goes back and forth. And, yeah, and you can drive?
I can drive.
Do you drive?
I don't drive. I live in a city, so I just take the light rail everywhere.
Do you have a license?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. See, my daughter, she's about to turn 24. She never did get a license. Lived in the city and went to another city and is moving to another city. So
yeah.
It's like, why drive?
I keep hearing that young people are not getting their licenses. I find it so inspiring. It's really cool.
Yeah, yeah. I have not really driven other than like a road trip or two every summer in a couple of years.
Hmm. Now, are you from the Twin Cities?
I'm from like the North Metro in Elk River.
Oh, okay. Well, that counts. That's the greater.
Greater
I'd like
Twin
to say
cities,
the greater St. Paul area. I'm from St. Paul, so we'll extend it there.
Yeah.
So that's was that a big deal for you to then go to the city?
Not really. I spent a lot of my teenage years in Minneapolis, just like being involved in different things here, and also just like already being really engaged with art and music community that was happening here. So I would sort of like commute to go do my recreational stuff, like going to shows and museums and stuff like that in high school.
Why did you want to go to school here too? I mean,
you know,
it's so comfortable.
Yeah, that was, I honestly was not my first choice. I really wanted to go to a school in Chicago and they didn't give me the scholarship that I wanted.
Oh.
The classic tale of a millennial. But yeah, so I ended up here not thinking that I was going to enjoy it, and it ended up being such a great fit for me because Minneapolis has that like really great thriving creative scene, and I'm also able to sort of like study the sciences and sort of engage with that practice as well. So it's been a really good fit, better than I would have ever imagined.
Who needs Chicago?
Yeah.
Gosh, and where are you from, Lana?
I was born in Arizona, but I'm kind of from all over the place. So
because you've lived around?
Yeah, my family moved a lot when I was a kid, so we moved between the west coast of the U.S., and Canada, and also places in the Middle East, like Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and Jordan.
Well, is Minnesota your favorite place out of all those locations?
You know, I have to say it kind of is.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
I was half jesting because...
No, this is the longest... I've lived in Minnesota the longest of all the places I had before. I moved here as a graduate student and just kind of really fell in love with the cities, fell in love with a Minnesotan, and that's part of the reason that I'm here as well.
So
I got married to
husband.
Yes. Right.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So but to go on vacation, if you have to get away from Minnesota, where would you go?
Well, I always, you know, I'm drawn to visit family. My family, my parents and sisters are in Northern California. So we find ourselves there quite a bit in the Sacramento area and the Bay Area.
Well, that's beautiful there.
It is, yeah. We're planning an upcoming trip to Amman, Jordan. I want to take my boys and my husband. It's been nearly 20 years since I've been back. So I'm looking forward to visiting the city and seeing some of the beautiful archaeological sites.
Well, see, that's what's kind of stressful is that because of all the wars going on in the Middle East, that's where civilization was born, right? You have all these ancient things and everything was invented there. You know, it's kind of sad, but it's good to know a lot of it still exists.
Yeah, there are some beautiful ruins there. And it's true that in like neighboring Syria, a lot of there's just been so much, and in Iraq, devastation because of war. That's just tragic to think about. But my family is also, my parents are both Palestinian, so that's kind of the origin of who I am. And that's something that is a big part of myself as well.
Hmm. Do you speak Arabic?
A little bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that something your parents...
It's rusty.
Okay. Your parents to drill that into you or...
No, it's that classic tale of an immigrant family who were working on mastering their English. And so the Arabic was, you know, kind of a back burner kind of thing.
There's a lot of parents think that if you don't always speak English, they won't learn English.
Right.
But you're in America, for crying out loud. Yeah. You go outside, you know, you play with any kids or watch TV.
The English kids are going to soak in the English. And I think that's kind of understood more. These days, I see so many young immigrant families where there is a preservation of the language, and knowing like a confidence that the kids are going to get English from school and from everywhere else, right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you're drowning in English, and you have the advantage now too for kids coming up that there's probably a lot of online media in Arabic, so they can get their ears adjusted and learn from that.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah.
So I know in my case, my wife is from Japan. So that was a big thing with our daughter is to make sure there was a lot of Japanese language around. So first grandma would send the videos and then we would get the satellite TV and then, you know, finally the internet came. Mm. So then that became the medium to get the language across. But it's an effort.
It is. Yeah. And we teach Arabic classes. We offer them through Mizna. And a lot of the students that we have are, it's kind of community ed, you know, and a lot of the students we have are Arab American young people or people who are young adults who are kind of in the same boat of trying to master a language that their parents didn't convey.
Mm-hmm. So there's such a strong link between language and culture. Did you learn a second language, Maddie?
I've taken French for about 6 years. Yeah.
Okay. So you can do what?
I like watching like French cinema or reading in it. I'm not as confident of a speaker as I'd like to be, but yeah, still learning.
Gosh, my daughter learned French too. And she, so then to pretend to study, she would watch movies, but turn on the French subtitles. And so I'm studying.
Yeah.
It's a way we couldn't do. So there's a strong link between language and culture. So you'd try to, I assume Lana, try to maintain as much cultural connections as you can, given that you're living in Minnesota.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what being involved with Mizna really does for me. It kind of feeds my soul in that way, you know, so I get to be always reading incredible new writers' work and watching cinema, listening to music. And there are a lot of people in town who are doing some really incredible things. A lot of artists here. There's a local Syrian musician whose music name is Hello Psycholepo. I wonder if you know about him.
I'm not super familiar with him.
You can exchange notes.
Yeah,
I'll
have to tag.
He does electronic dance music. That's kind of a new genre that he created called electro tarab, which is taking a kind of a classic Arabic music style and electronifying it, if that's a word.
Electrifying.
He does a beautiful, beautiful work. Yeah. And he's kind of flying under the radar here a little bit, but he's really, he has a big reputation in Europe and the Middle East. He plays to big audiences.
Cool.
Yeah. When he can get over there, given his visa status and the Muslim ban and that sort of thing.
Oh, what a pain that is.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm wondering, one of the hopes for the future is that the newer generations are not as messed up as the older ones, you know, in so many ways in terms of open-mindedness and understanding differences. What is it like? Of course, you're 20 years old, but you're hanging around a bunch of radicals at Radio K, right? It's,
yeah.
It's not like you're
they're
in
a
the young, you're not the Young Republicans Club.
Not quite.
So what are your attitudes towards a lot of the current events going on?
Yeah, so that's like stressful being any sort of person, just sort of like living under an administration that is causing a lot of fear and aims to do so. And sort of just like through the work that I do, it's more of like an indirect sort of a, I don't want to say like retaliation, but sort of an indirect
reaction.
Yeah, reaction to like what's going on, and that like I'm not able to change policy. I can go vote and do my normal civic stuff like that, but I really work to put on the radio voices that are not traditionally represented through those like sort of mediums, really like working to make sure that like people from different cultural backgrounds, international artists, women who are still extremely underrepresented in radio in general, and people of color, just giving those people like a voice and a platform when they traditionally like haven't been, it's like been one of our big goals as a station, in just like our small way that we can like reach out and make sure that we have the representation there.
Because for me, it's developing the ear.
Yeah, I mean, definitely.
I'm fortunate. My father played jazz. I mean, that wasn't his main job, but he, you know, played jazz on weekends and had jazz music around the house. And here I'm a little kid growing up in the 60s. So
right.
It's at first it was the Kingston Trio and then it was the Beatles and all that stuff. But then when I started going to college, I got tired of rock and went to jazz. So I had the ear and I was still able to do that. I think the way you wire your brain when you're young makes a big difference.
Definitely, yeah.
So I know, and for bilingual, you probably run into a lot of bilinguals, Alana.
Yeah.
Or trilinguals.
That's right, yeah.
So their brains are wired differently.
That's right, yeah. I don't know too much about this, but I mean, just the capacity of the brain to learn multiple languages as a kid is so, it's really deep. And then the connections between learning language and being open to really complex ideas in terms of mathematics and other kind of conceptual ideas is supposed to be really strong. I think about that with my children.
Well, good.
Yeah.
So are they learning Arabic?
My son, Omar, is a fifth grader at Lindale Community School, a South Minneapolis school, that is the only elementary school that has an Arabic program.
And they do?
They do. It's cool. It's a public school, and it has Arabic. Rita Farah has an incredible Arabic teacher there. She teaches at some other public schools at higher grades as well. But fifth graders begin Arabic. So this is the year, this is his year. So
finally.
He's probably actually taking Arabic maybe as we speak.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool. Now, have you faced any lashback because of all the anti-Arab and anti-Muslim sentiment that's been sweeping the nation and Europe?
Yeah. You know, we are sort of shielded from it somehow. I think the audience who's drawn to our work isn't that audience, for better or worse.
They don't want to go there to watch a good Arabic movie.
Yeah, I suppose. When we feel it is when we do things like sponsored ads on social media, when we're reaching an audience outside of people who've decided to, you know, engage with our work. And that's where you get really kind of hateful comments and really mean-spirited things. And that's disturbing. You know, every once in a while we'll have an act of vandalism. Like our offices used to be in the California building in Northeast, and we'd have the occasional remark on materials outside of our door. It's always
little graffiti.
That's, you know, things like no jihad. As a response to what we're doing, you know, and it's kind of expected, but it also, you know, it's a kind of a psychic trauma to see that, like, oh yeah, that's right. This is why we do what we do.
Boy, well, there's so much. I mean, my theme in life is trying to understand things because when I grew up, well, the 60s, everything was so confusing that, you know, I wanted, why is this happening? Why do people have to fight for no reason? I mean, people usually fight over land or wealth or women or, you know, there's usually some objects. But when it's just a mistaken different ideas, then I think it's totally unjustifiable. So, but that's what we have. We live in a world, well, I mean, when I played my music when I was young, I mean, in those days, Hendrix was brand new and all that. I went to see him twice, by the way.
No way.
So, but then there was the generation gap. That was the big thing in understanding, especially at that time. I don't know, does your mother or parents, do they listen to your music and think, gosh, what are you doing at that radio K?
Yeah, my parents don't tune in all the time, but I did a whole like goth set once where I was doing a bunch of like sort of like weird dark wave or like experimental stuff, and my mom tuned in and she was like, what is going on? Like, is this okay? But for the most part, they love supporting me. And I know my mom used to like take me to 18 plus concerts when I was underage. So we have a good bond through that, and they've like tried to understand and opened up a lot to a lot of different stuff sort of through what I'm doing.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
To maintain a line of communication.
Yeah, totally.
Even if they don't dance along with your goth. What was that?
It was just like a whole like dark wave set that I was
dark
doing.
Dark wave. I've never heard that. Right. Dark wave.
Yeah.
It was just.
That's how old wave I am.
Right.
It was fun stuff. I got a text from my mom that was so cute a couple weeks ago. She's like, have you heard of this band Snail Mail? I was listening to The Current and I heard them play a song and thought you would like them. And I was like, yeah, Mom, I love them. Like, that's awesome. It was really cute.
So now, for a person, my daughter loves radio. She loves The Current, and you can get that online. So she lives in New York now.
That's
but
awesome.
How would you, as an insider, compare The Current and Radio K? What's objectively, or is The Current more mainstream, or are they more eclectic?
Yeah, so just from hosts and DJs, we're like the most amateur you can get. You go through a DJ training program and stuff. You have your practice shifts. But like everyone is a student, and most people DJ 3 hours a week and don't think about it any other time.
Mm. You're not smooth like this.
No. It's like, and those are career DJs who like have great personalities and have like a lot of people who love that about them. But there's a lot more polish there. And some people really don't like listening to people stumble over their words on the radio, and that'll be a deterrent. And some people think it's really charming. Mm. So just that's one aspect of it for sure. I think Radio K too, we have a lot, I think we have more eclectic programming where The Current is like more focused on keeping like a certain like rotation and stuff like that. They definitely introduce their listeners to a ton of new music, and that's awesome. But it's in a lot more sort of like controlled way versus like Radio K, where like you could tune into a show and not know what you're going to hear. We have a whole specialty show dedicated to vaporwave, and I think we're the only one, still the only station that does that. And it's just this
vaporwave.
Yeah, it's this weird internet subgenre that doesn't have that many people listening to it, and we have like an hour of it on every single week, which is it's a super like quirky little example. But stuff like that is like I think the biggest difference.
Vaporwave, dark wave.
All these waves.
It's an education wave thing.
Yeah.
Now, does the money mainly come from the University of Minnesota, or do you rely on sponsors?
It's a good combination. We have a great relationship with student service fees at the U, and so as like a student group, we're able to get some of our funding through that. We have biannual pledge drives. One is coming up next month already. There's so much work that goes into that, but we ask for money from our listeners and are lucky enough to get a lot of donations from that. And then we also work for some grants, especially for our like newer programming. Like we have a couple podcasts that have started up, and we restructured the way we do our local show, and stuff like that is able to get funded by grant money.
Okay. Boy, at KFAI where I was, we did those pledge drives. I hated it. Okay, now we're going to hold you ransom and talk about all this money stuff instead of playing our records like we want to do. You're listening to a non-musical program, although it sounds like we should be one. I'm Steve LeBeau. We're here on Synapse Think Tank of the Air. We're here on with Lana Barkawi and Maddie Schwapik. We'll be back in a moment.
Synapse Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back in a moment.
And we're back on Synapse Think Tank of the Air, talking with two scientists that are both in the art world, more or less, at least for the moment. Maddie, you were saying about radio, it's kind of an old-fashioned thing.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your future in radio?
Yeah, that's the big question mark, I think, for everyone in the industry. And I've talked to a lot of people about it, and I think the way that I look at it is radio is still really necessary in this world for sort of like the community aspect and sort of working, having a platform for artists, both touring bands that come in through town and local artists who are like getting a start. I can build a Spotify playlist and share it with my friends, but it's not the same experience as having a platform that a bunch of people can go to for music discovery and working on doing things like recording in studios and interviews, sponsoring shows and all of that kind of stuff. And So in that way, radio is kind of transformed into this multimedia sort of entity instead of just being on the airwaves like it used to be.
Hmm. Does Mizna have a podcast?
You know, we dabbled in it. So we do have a podcast identity called Mizna Stream, and we have a few pre-recorded events of ours. Actually, that conversation that you went to about Islamophobia, it was our premiere episode.
Oh, so that exists somewhere.
It exists somewhere. You can find it on, you know, iTunes and Stitcher and all the places that you find podcasts. But it was something that we dabbled in and just kind of didn't have the capacity to keep up. So we have a little bit of a stockpile of recordings of author events and other conversations, panels that live on our hard drives and just haven't made it to the podcast. So it's sort of dormant, I would say.
It's in your long-term memory back there somewhere.
All right, yeah.
Laying around.
Yeah.
Now you have a film series coming up.
Yes, the Twin Cities Arab Film Festival.
How many films are in that?
It's still kind of becoming concrete, but it'll probably shake out to about 27 to 30 films.
That's a huge number.
It is, yeah. It's a mix of feature length films and shorts.
Okay.
And so some segments will pair a short and a feature length, and then we'll have other segments that is a segment of experimental shorts or local shorts, that sort of thing.
What languages are they in?
Oh, that's a great question. Many of the films are in Arabic or other languages that occur in the Middle East. There's a film, a film in Kurdish that's an Iraqi film that we have that's all in Kurdish. And all the films that we have that are not English are subtitled. So it's definitely accessible for sort of any English speaker as well.
Hmm. So quite a bit of variety.
It's true, a variety of genre. So we have documentaries and narrative features, shorts that are both documentary and narrative. And also increasingly we have, since the very first film festival, we've always loved to have experimental film that kind of are meditative or just kind of maybe challenge the viewer.
Kind of like a Radio K film.
Yeah. There's probably some crossover.
Some Arab wave.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And this year, because it's the 70th year of the Israeli occupation of Palestine, we're commemorating that by having a focus on Palestine. So the film festival takes place over 4 days, September 27th through the 30th. And the last day is all Palestinian film.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where do you show these films?
At St. Anthony Main Theater in partnership with the Film Society. So it's on the Film Society's Screen 3 at the St. Anthony Main Theater in Minneapolis, right on the river there.
The Mississippi River.
Yeah.
Well, I remember seeing
Main Street.
One of the international films. And I think it was a co-production between Finland and Hungary. And so then, for part of the film, they'd speak in Hungarian.
Mm.
And part of the film, they'd speak in Finnish. But when they'd get together, then they'd speak English. Because that was their most common second language.
Mm-hmm.
But then
franca.
If they encountered someone that didn't speak English, then they'd go to German. That would be their their backup to that language.
Must be nice to have a Rolodex of languages like that.
Yeah.
Here in Minnesota, all we have is different accents. You know, do you have the Fargo accent or not? And then what are you speaking at, at the Yellow Summit coming up on September 14th, which is, that's really soon.
Yeah, it's just a couple weeks away. It's cool. I've been involved with it for so many months that it's like nice to have it just right around the corner. My speech is sort of centering around what it takes to get arts and sciences integrated in like a team or in a project.
That's like yourself.
Yeah, it really is.
And be me.
Yeah, just be just like me. No, I'm just talking about some sort of like experiences that I've had working in engineering, working in music, that I've experienced really direct crossover and like what I've learned from those and like what I think I could share with other people from that.
Hmm. And you say you've been working on a speech. Is this like a TEDx talk or something?
Yeah, I think I'm presenting for 50 minutes. So it's
50,
it's
5-0?
Yeah. So I'm
gosh, that's like an hour.
It's really close to that. Yeah. It's a long speech and it's cool. It's a different sort of a challenge from other things that I've faced to sort of summarize the things that I've learned in just really the past few years. I'm just barely getting my toes wet in it, but I think that that's perspective.
Who's the audience?
Yeah, it's a variety of people from the Twin Cities who are both sort of like entrepreneurs and working in startups and stuff like that. Creatives who are working in the creative industry in some way or another, and that's sort of like very loose terminology, but people who are working directly in arts and with artistic people, and then also people who are working on sort of like the tech side of things.
Because that's what Yellow's about, yeah. That interface between tech and creativity.
Yeah, there's going to be some really interesting things going on. I know they're opening up with a performance that involves both contemporary dance and the performer is working with technology within her piece, too. Mm. So it should be really interesting.
Boy, so 50 minutes. Are you going to have slides or music? Or, you know,
yeah, it's going to
bring out the oboe?
I haven't thought about that yet. I'll ask if they can hook me up and give me an oboe amp or something. No, it's mostly just slides and a little bit of like video and sort of like animated stuff too.
Mm. Is it, I mean, I think of young people, you think they're born with a computer, you know, with a laptop, you know, as soon as they start breastfeeding, they're, you know,
yeah,
typing something up. Is there a gap between the young artists and technology, or do the young artists glum onto technology along with their art?
Yeah, I think there's a lot more integration in there than there probably was in the past. I think since young people have just, technology's always been a part of my life. I've had a laptop since, I don't know, I was 10 or 12 years old or something like that. And that sort of integration makes art a lot more accessible too. Like, if you're someone who's recording music and you can do it on your laptop with a $200 mic instead of trying to go into a studio for thousands of dollars, it made it a lot more accessible to sort of broaden your artistic reach as a young person without a ton of finances, which is cool.
Mm. Mm. Rather than just pencil and paper.
Yeah.
Going beyond all that.
Definitely.
And for your arts resources, Lana, I think you can draw from all over the world too for any kind of artistic endeavor, because you have contacts everywhere. I was looking up some of the people you have. They're global citizens.
Yeah, absolutely. That's true. In fact, we're trying to invite some filmmakers and actors from the Middle East to our film festival. We often have visitors, and it's always a nice experience for, you know, audience members to engage with someone who made a film or acted in a film after the film ends. I think it adds so much depth to that experience. But it's always touch and go with, travel issues and travel bans. And in fact, there's a filmmaker who's Syrian with a Syrian passport who's based in Paris right now. And we'd like to invite her with her film. And she doesn't know if she'll get her visa. And if she gets it, she's quite concerned about being hassled at the airport. So
she's
these are the kinds of things we deal with.
She's from one of the wrong countries.
That's right.
One of the banned countries, yeah. The so-called the most dangerous countries.
That's right.
Yeah. What do you do? And I see you have all your hair left. Why don't you pull it out? I mean, don't you feel
it's
like
turning
just
gray?
It out?
It's turning gray for sure. But I think that these kinds of things, the state of the world and the state of the country, I would feel so much more forlorn about it if I wasn't doing the work that I'm doing. It kind of helps me kind of process things because I get to read and listen to and see the way that artists are kind of taking the world and shifting it through their prism. And it just makes it's sort of a, gives me the world that I desire to live in through sort of the artist's vision.
Boy, that's kind of interesting that, that's kind of the value, especially theater and opera. They bring you into a different reality altogether, and then different music and artworks can do that too. And here we live in the world where the president has an alternate reality that's not based on factual reality.
Yeah.
And so it's gosh, what can you glum onto to get your feet on the ground.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's dizzying.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in our upcoming issue of the literary journal is also in the same way that the film festival is focusing on Palestine. We have a themed issue of our lit journal that's coming up in the winter that's also kind of commemorating the 70 years of occupation. And one of the themes of that, one of the sort of sub-themes, is kind of a speculative fiction and thinking about what the future could hold, you know, and kind of imagining worlds. And I love that. And I think that that's something that Arab artists do so much in their work, is to kind of not feel shackled by our reality, but kind of imagine what can be.
That's the value of art, artistry.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just wondering, you know, we recently saw the film, my wife and I, who's, like I said, Japanese, we saw Crazy Rich Asians.
Yeah.
And so finally, after 25 years since the last one, a film that's produced and starred a bunch of Asian people.
Right.
I mean, is there any idea
Asian
for,
cast.
I mean, I can, just the title, I don't know if that rings very well, Crazy Rich Arabs, you know, because there are such things,
yeah.
but has anybody thought, well, why don't we do our film with all, you know, Arab actors and stuff?
Mm-hmm. Well, there have been some kind of Hollywood releases that are Arab films, not very many. Amrika and Caramel, I think both by Nadine Labeki. Oh, I might have that wrong. I think maybe Amrika was by a different director, Shireen Debbis. But I think the idea of Arabs taking over Hollywood is exciting. one of the directors, Nadine Labeki, who's just a really brilliant filmmaker, her new film, Kafir Naam, was a big hit at Cannes and is getting a lot of attention and acclaim. And it also will be screening at the Toronto International Film Festival. And it's going to be a really special presentation at our film festival, a co-presentation with the Film Society, and it's sort of a special North American preview before it hits theaters. So that will be a film that will be in indie theaters around the country come December, I think. But you can see it at the film festival on opening night on Thursday.
Okay.
And hopefully Nadine will be here too.
Well, that'd be great.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's nice to have real people. I mean, growing up, I always had a sense that the people on TV were more real than the people you see every day.
But, yeah.
And then if you can bring them there and live, then it's a real nice reality, an ultimate reality. Do you pick out the films? Or are you just more of the administrator, or how does that work?
I don't pick out the films. I don't. We have a terrific Film Fest curator, Michelle Baroudi, an Arab American woman who's getting her PhD in cultural studies, and she's been our curator for a few years and has been involved with the film festival for a number of years before that. So she is the curator. She also works with a selection committee who screens a lot of the films that we get submitted to us. And so there's a pretty involved selection process to select a really great set of films that hangs well together and does the work of kind of representing different genres, different identities, different places in the world across the Middle East and North Africa. It's a big kind of project to curate a festival that feels balanced in all of the ways that are important to us. And
right.
She does a really fabulous job.
Boy, and you say they picked about, what, between 20 and 30 films?
Yeah.
And so then they must have watched 50 or 60.
More, yeah.
More.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh,
yeah.
Well, that's good. They have a lot to choose from, all the different countries that produces films.
Yeah, that's true.
What's the biggest Arab-producing film country?
Oh, that's a good question. It's probably either Egypt or Lebanon, but probably Egypt. Egypt has a very strong cinema history. That
Not goes Omar back. Sharif?
That's right. Omar Sharif, who
Egyptian.
Passed away a couple of years ago, sadly. But yeah, he was the rare kind of crossover actor who was a very big deal in the Middle East and a very, very big deal here as well.
When I was a kid, they had Lawrence of Arabia come out.
Yeah.
And he was one of the actual Arabs playing an Arab.
Yeah, that's right.
They
that's
had
right.
Mexicans and British.
Right,
and
right. What a
all
concept.
Kinds of people,
self-representation.
That makeup is so effective.
Yeah.
You're growing. You've never seen the movie?
I haven't seen that one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it's considered a masterpiece, but I don't know what would be the Arab perspective of it.
You know, I have to admit, I don't know that much about that film. I haven't seen the film, and
okay.
I'm not sure what the ideas of it are in terms of Arab scholarship. Something I need to find out.
Right. Well, it's from the perspective of a blue-eyed, blonde English guy.
And
then I think that describes the director as well.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think the idea of films made about the Middle East by Westerners is something we don't show at our film festival, if I can say that.
Yeah. Unless it's ironically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. And then what was it in the silent days? The Sheikh? That was the big,
right.
You know, so Arabs went from this romantic kind of idealistic, you know, probably historically inaccurate figures, mm-hmm. to all of a sudden all the bad guys.
That's right. Yeah.
Gosh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Orientalism is a long problem. There's Islamophobia, you know, that is kind of a new facet of something I think that is, you know, decades and hundreds of years old that Edward Said, the scholar, you know, wrote so cogently about.
Hmm. Well, come to think, I think I voted for an Egyptian-American, Ralph Nader, right?
Wasn't yeah. Lebanese.
Lebanese?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's...
That's right.
Now, just to clear up things, just showing my ignorance, So there's Saudi Arabia, but the mm-hmm. Arab people, how far do they span mm-hmm. out across the Middle East and Northern Africa and beyond?
Yeah.
Is there?
Mm-hmm.
I'm
yeah.
asking you for a little geography lesson.
Right. Well, yeah. Arab identity is kind of a limiting descriptor of a people group, but it's kind of the best that we have. But it's kind of based in a common language and to a certain extent a common culture. And it's so the Arab people are from Morocco across the middle, across North Africa, including
Libya,
mm-hmm, Algeria, Morocco, Egypt, Tunisia. You're going to have me recount the 21 countries.
21 countries. Well, that's a.
Yeah. And then into the Middle East, which is effectively West Asia, right? Mm. So the Levant and the Persian Gulf. And there's a distinction between Arabs and Iranians. Within the Arab world, there are a lot of minority groups or occupied people who don't consider themselves Arab, too.
Oh, right.
And we love having films and work.
The Kurds,
the Chaldeans in Iraq, the Berbers in North Africa. Yeah, and others, the Copts in Egypt.
Okay, well, I think you've just tripled my knowledge of the Arab culture.
These are people who might not feel like they want to call themselves Arabs, you know? So this is something that we grapple with in our work, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, my gosh, we've run out of time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll have to go see some movies and see a nice lecture with the oboe solo in the middle of it. Thanks for being here on Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. Lana Barkawi. Stay tuned for the Mizna Film Fest coming up, the Arab Film Fest coming up in 27th through the 30th of September. And Maddie Schwapak, you'll be speaking at the Yellow Summit on September 14th. Are you all rehearsed?
I'm ready.
Okay. She's ready, everybody. Okay. Well, thanks for joining us, and we'll be back again.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to Synapse. Think Tank of the Air. I'm Leo Espinosa.